Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and today we have our special biannual conference review. This last weekend, April 2nd and 3rd, 2011, was the 181st annual conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And the way this works is we assembled a five Tiger teams to listen to each session, and then shortly thereafter we assembled together either in person or via the airwaves to record our review and impression of the conference. Thanks to everyone who participated. We couldn't do it without your help. Well, here we go.
All right, welcome to another edition of Mormon Expression. I think this is kicking off our conference edition for April 2011. And what is this? This is 181st annual conference. And joined by a panel of a lot of returning panelists. We've got some regulars. So rounding us out, let's start with George, one of the original Mormon Expression panelist, back to weigh in on conference. George, how you doing? It's been a while.
I'm doing great. Great to be back involved, and interesting to be back in on a conference session. It's going to be an adventure.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. Good to hear your voice again.
Thanks so much.
Also coming back, we've got Bridget.
Hey there, Glenn. Good to be back.
Yeah, glad to have you back. And I mentioned to a few people you were going to be on, and I know there's a few people that are, well, I said a few people. There's tons of people out there, Bridget, that are just excited to hear from you.
Oh, well, I'm excited to be back.
Tons. All right. And we've got Robin.
Hello.
You excited for this, Robin?
Oh, I am. This is my first conference commentary. I'm so excited.
And doing it on Skype with a brand new microphone.
Oh, yes.
Right. We're all excited here. And then rounding us out, we've got Nathan.
Hello. I'm actually glad George is back as well. He's been one of my favorites after Nile. But
after
Nile. That's familial. So.
Right, yeah. And Nathan, you've been on a few times before.
A few.
Yeah.
And well, this is my first conference.
You know, we've mentioned Nile. Nile is your brother, and
right.
Yeah. So we've just finished watching the first session of Saturday morning conference. It just ended about half an hour ago, and we're going to go through the talks. Try and keep this about 30 minutes. You know, one of the things that I noticed right off the bat as Uchtdorf was conducting, he threw in at the beginning that this was the 75th anniversary of the welfare program. Did that strike any of you as odd?
No, I would have expected it. I mean, it seemed to set the tone for this session, and I imagine it's going to set the tone for the remainder of the sessions, as it has with, I mean, any time you have some sort of historical significant event.
I would totally agree. I thought it was kind of odd that they pointed it out, but after hearing all the talks that mentioned it, it made total sense.
Yeah, so when you say made total sense, you're thinking of the Japan earthquake as the main reason?
No, they mentioned the fact that this year they're going to have another one of those humanitarian days, a day of service to celebrate the 75th year. There was two, I wrote down, I think there was two or maybe even three talks that somehow referenced back to the welfare program.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I saw that this became kind of the opening salvo to what was a common theme throughout, and maybe I've got more of a cynical take on it. I think they're positioning for the presidential run of Romney and Huntsman, but I don't know.
I didn't catch that quite a bit. I mean,
okay.
the humanitarian arm of the church has long been a modern pillar of Mormonism. To really attach it to a political leading, I think, is a little disingenuous, but not outside the realm of possibility.
Okay. All right. So he opened it up. Uchtdorf did, and our first speaker was President Monson, and he opened it up with a bit of a joke. What'd you guys think of that joke? He said that when they built the tabernacle, they didn't think that they would fill it.
Yeah, I actually wrote a note down on that because I was totally blown away that they really thought that they wouldn't fill that. I mean, it was full the first time to overflowing. I don't think it was ever intended that they wouldn't fill that thing out. That was really an odd statement for me.
Yeah,
disingenuous.
I think it was just meant to be a joke.
It didn't seem like it went over. He didn't really get much of a reaction from it, did he?
No.
I actually went to conference in the Tabernacle in, I think it was 1999, the very last conference that they had, October 1999. It was the last one they had in the Tabernacle. And that place was packed, and people were sitting out in, you know, the overflow seating and nearby chapels. And, yeah, I think they knew that they had enough people to fill the conference center.
Yeah. So, you know, at the end of Monson's talk, and we'll go back and talk about the contents in a moment, but it was followed by the hymn by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir that said, "We listen to a prophet's voice and we hear the Savior's voice for what we should do." And it just made me wonder, is that what we had just heard with President Monson? So I kind of want to frame our discussion of what Monson said with that question.
It seemed to be completely business. It was administrative almost entirely, and a reiteration of the same themes that President Ubdorf had placed. I mean, I wouldn't say that it was any more prophetic as it was just saying, I'm the spokesperson for this church and I'm here to tick off some lists. I mean, we're going to see it again tomorrow morning when he goes over when he or the other first presidency, who are also supposedly prophets, are going to be going over the financial statements of the church. Yeah. It's business.
Now, to be fair, I think that most active and fully believing members of the church would say that the announcement of the three temples, the three new temples, would be a prophetic announcement. That's always been kind of one of those things that said that's what Revelation does is keep us moving, keep the work moving. There's going to be a lot of people that are going to say, yeah, didn't you hear the new Revelation? You know, three new temples.
What do you think, Bridget? You know, because when you look at this, and for people who aren't familiar with your background, you're not LDS, you're evangelical, so you always look at this from an outside perspective. Does this fit with what you would expect a prophet, you know, would do?
I feel like it's cynical to say it, but I remember somebody in the Blogger Knackle once commented that, sure, Latter-day Saints believe in modern-day revelation, but it's not very modern or revelatory. And I think I've always been a little bit disappointed with what actually comes out of General Conference. It just has never felt very revelatory to me. Mm. And, of course, my LDS friends will say, you know, does it always have to be new revelation? How much of the Bible was new revelation? You know, there are periods in the Bible where they're not really saying anything new. They're just repeating old stuff. Okay, I get that. It's just I don't feel very much fire or passion, I guess, when I listen to General Conference. It's just they strike me as nice denominational leaders. It's not much different than listening to denominational leaders, only without speaking training and interesting sermons. Yeah. So I guess that's how I view it.
Yeah. Anything to add there, Robin?
Well, yes. You were mentioning, well, or someone did, about it being kind of business oriented. And I thought, as a good manager, he started off in a lovely way by praising the members, talking about, you know, the church, praising the church's efforts and the members' efforts, the 70 tons of supplies, 40,000 hours of service by over 4,000 volunteers, talking about how many missionaries, how many missions, and then, of course, gave us what he wants to see. He asked for one thing, which is basically he said to, you know, he praised everyone for paying tithes and offerings, and then asked that people look to pay more towards the missionary fund, since missionary work is the lifeblood of the kingdom.
Yeah. There's a technique in humor that's called understatement. And if you're familiar with the movie Wayne's World, they do this when there's a joke about Cleveland, you know, like visiting the lovely Cleveland, where they, you know, kind of go. They're talking about all these exotic locations, and then it's Cleveland. And I kind of felt like that, where he was talking about his experience in the Hawaii temple with all these wonderful spiritual experiences. It's just kind of a glowing narrative. And then he announces these three places where the temples are going to be. And it kind of had that effect on me. It was kind of like understatement. And I don't mean to be offensive to anybody who lives in these places, but it just didn't seem like Fort Collins, Colorado, or Meridian, Idaho, or Winnipeg, Canada seemed like, I don't know, spiritually glowing Laie, Hawaii type places to me. So it almost seemed comical the way that I took it. But yeah, that was kind of my read with Monster. And I, you know, the one thing that I wondered, because I was, you know, I lived in Tokyo for a while, so I was interested in the humanitarian efforts from the single members that were seeking out people there with the, what did he say, the internet, social media, and other means of modern communication. If you've got a Urim and Thummim, that would help.
I thought that was going to come up.
Okay, well, we better move on. So next one was L. Tom Perry.
Yeah, so he really gave a great talk. I thought it was a good talk on Christ. One of the things that I thought he, quote, I thought he really nailed it on was this idea that Christ has a dual citizenship in both heaven and earth. I liked that, and it really resonated with me. He talked a lot about keeping the Sabbath day holy, worshiping the Lord, talked about the fact that the Sabbath day is the cornerstone of Sabbath observance. Says that we should do three things in resting from our labors. We should keep ourselves unspotted, we should go to the house of prayer, and we should rest from our labors, and said that it's glorious to be a Christian. Then he kind of went down a route that I found kind of interesting. He talked about really the fact that Christ desires us to dress appropriately, and that it might not be necessary to actually keep our children in church clothes until the sun goes down. And that was really interesting. And then he also talked about the fact that we need to be careful about what worldly work items that we do on the Sabbath day. He said, rest on the Sabbath day includes resting from work that you can do from home on Sunday. And so he really narrowed it down on two different things, what we can and cannot do, and then how we dress makes a big, big deal, even at home. And so I'm expecting a lot of homes tomorrow, even for conference, families are going to get their kids up in the morning, get them dressed, and sit them down on the couch and watch conference. And then around sundown, they're going to say, okay, you can get your PJs on now.
Yeah. Yeah, so I got that sense as well. Right.
That's my summary of that's what I took away from it.
Yeah. Robin, what'd you think?
Yeah, I noted some of the exact same things that George did, or at least the dual citizenship. I did find that something, I think, with the problems we've got with immigration going on, that dual citizenship, I think, was kind of an olive branch of kindness, which was nice. That's about all I have to say.
Okay, Nathan?
Oh, goodness. Well, other than being a typical apostle talk in the church, one thing that really stuck out for me was his reiteration and reclaim of evangelical terms. I mean, yeah. He kept saying Christian and
right.
believers and things like that, and what it just seemed to me that he seemed to be making a very subtle effort to like reclaim these terms for Mormons, since there's so many outside of the Mormon community, especially in the evangelical community, that do not consider Mormons to be Christian in any sort. I would love to get your take on this, Bridget, seeing as your background is more evangelical than mine was.
Yeah, I noticed some of those same things. I noticed he was using a little bit more, I guess you could call it, evangelical terminology. And honestly, I thought it was a good talk for a general conference talk. I liked how he talked about the symbolism of the sacrament and what it meant. And I liked how he talked about keeping the Sabbath day holy, and evangelicals would call that the Sabbatarian position, and what to do on the Sabbath and what you can't do. I did chuckle a little bit when he said you need to dress up for church, basically, because casual dress means casual attitudes.
Yeah.
I don't think that's true at all. But, of course, I go to a church where people dress casually if they want to, so maybe I'm a little biased on it, but I think it's what's on the inside that counts.
Yeah.
Then again, I'm also okay with the idea of creating space and doing your Sabbath differently than how you would do other days. That's okay to me, but I don't think you should look down on people who dress casually.
Right.
So, but, yeah, I noticed some of that same stuff, and, you know, it's not that unusual for Mormons to use terminology like Christian and believer and things like that. So,
you know, we do need to move on to the next speaker, but he mentioned that we're supposed to confess our sins to our brethren, and I don't think we do enough of that. So maybe we should just go around and just confess one sin to each other before we move on. Could we do that real quick? Robin?
He said to your brethren, not to your sistren, so I guess me and Robin are out.
No.
But I know Robin's kind of chomping at the bit.
I'll step out.
All right.
Oh, my heavens, my list is so long, I can't possibly choose just one.
Well, then let's just have guilty pleasures and just start with Jean A. Stevens as our first one, because she was the next...
Ooh.
Yeah, we can just have our discussion of her be our collective group sin. Evil
she
speaking.
Can handle it.
Evil speaking of the Lord's anointed, maybe. I don't
here we go. Here we go.
Yeah. So Jean A. Stevens.
She didn't wear a pastel colored dress.
Okay.
Blew me away. It was white or off white or something like that. It wasn't peach or anything like that. So. That was a shocker.
Yeah, I kind of checked out with her when she opened up with a story of the church leaders that used the primary children in Hong Kong to manipulate the parents into paying tithing.
Yeah, that kind of bugged me.
Whoa.
Yes.
Yeah. So, who wants to start with her?
I liked her talk.
Okay.
Honestly, I thought she gave a very good talk. I agree that it was kind of... It wasn't my favorite moment when she talked about the children in Hong Kong paying their tithing and how they used that to get the adults to pay tithing. I kind of thought, you know, if these are faithful members, shouldn't they have been paying tithing before that? But I liked her talk a lot. I really empathized with the idea of learning from our children. And I can't remember which theologian I was reading. It was a 19th century theologian. See, what a good church history student I am. Can't remember his name. But he talked about how... perhaps the reason why Jesus said the kingdom of heaven is like, or that children, you need to be like a child to go to heaven, is because he was arguing that children do go to heaven, even if they aren't baptized, and infants go to heaven. He was this 19th century theologian, and he said maybe that's why Jesus talked about how the kingdom of God is like a little child. Yeah. And I like that a lot, and I empathize. I get that some people would be like, oh, she's a woman, she's talking about children, that's so typical. But hey, you know what, she's a primary counselor, and that's expected.
Exactly.
And I thought she gave a good talk for what it was, and I rather enjoyed it. And I also thought she did a good job speaking, had a very clear voice. She was very easy for me to follow. She didn't have that sing-songy primary voice that some of the female speakers have. So
thank you.
I thought she did a good
out.
Job. I hope they call on her to speak again sometime. Probably not going to happen for years and years, but hey.
I pulled my hair out, Bridget. I'm glad you liked it. I pulled my hair out, and I was screaming audibly. I just couldn't take it.
Okay.
I couldn't take it. Go ahead, Nathan.
Well, part of that is that a lot of what her talk was essentially was. You know, fortune cookie speaking.
Yeah.
There's nothing bad that she's going to say that anybody's going to stand up other than just saying, okay, all right, we get it. Kids are great. I mean, kids are the future and we should be like kids. Right. We know that since we were in primary. But it's like, no, I mean, it's that was probably the most grating on me. It was just like, okay, all right, that's 5-7 minute talk on nothing really. I mean, kids are important. Great. All right.
I mean, I agree with what you're saying, Bridget. I do like that message. I mean, I think if you're talking about faith, humility, obedience, love, forgiveness, you know, being quick to those things, I think that's valuable. I do. But, you know, when she asked the question, you know, like, what is it that's the characteristics of a child that adults don't have? I thought, well, what about, you know, critical thinking? You know, kids can be taken advantage of really easily. They can be duped into things pretty easily. I mean, I don't know. It just...
Well, when she said, you know, when she refers to those who have lost faith to look at their primary age children, I think that's exactly kind of what you're looking at is, are we supposed to be, I mean, there's a lot of the subversion of our reason in faith. And I unfortunately think that's a bad road to go down. But
or the kid who writes a note and puts it on their parents' pillow that says, we want to be sealed in the temple, that, you know, that's sweet. It's nice. But maybe the kid doesn't know all of the things that are going on in the parent's life, you know, that might keep them from being sealed in the temple. I don't know.
Right. And you assume that it's because it's just a sweet child who, you know, wants this closeness with God and Christ, that sort of thing in a sealed family. But it could actually be the kid is having nightmares of worms crawling through his or her parents' eyes throughout the night and thinking, oh, if they're not sealed, you know, they're going to be in the ground being eaten up by worms.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
What a motivation is that? That's not love. That's fear.
Yeah.
So what I looked at this is I kind of went back and looked at this from a Fowler stages theory. Normally when we talk about Fowler, we're talking about people in stage 3, 4, and 5. And typically the Fowler thing refers to children and the kind of testimony they have as a stage 2. You know, they're non-reason, non-skeptical, non-reasoning type testimonies. But these are also the same type of folks who believe in Santa and the Easter Bunny and boogie monsters under the bed. And it almost seemed like she was saying, if you're in doubt or if you're trying to improve yourself, you need to have that type of a mentality and and look to those people as the example of how you should be.
Yeah.
And that really bugged me.
Yeah.
Does anyone want to say anything about Liam with the aggressive cancer and his radiation treatments? Several of them brought in cancer people. And I thought, they have to bring up cancer. It just tugs at the heartstrings.
Yeah.
And then when she mentioned no sedation, I was thinking about Joseph Smith.
Right.
That story we heard in primary over and over.
And that's no accident. I mean, it's one of those little traditional stories that we have stored up in these buckets, these boxes in our minds, that it's intentionally meant to go and tug on that. But, yeah. Okay, the next speaker.
Can we finish up, though?
She ended
with talking about S&M, that we should be submissive and meek.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so.
That's awesome.
And so full of love.
Yeah, all right. Okay.
I'm sorry, I just had to get it in there.
Okay.
That's awesome.
Walter Gonzalez was our next speaker, and this was my favorite, actually, of all of them. I really like this one. What did the rest of you think of Walter Gonzalez?
I thought it was a really good talk. He was basically admonishing us or celebrating the way that women are treated in the church, that wives are treated, that we're set up as an example of how men should treat women.
Oh, really? I just saw that as a kind of a throwaway introduction.
It was much more followed in, you know, Quentin Cook's talk.
I must have fallen asleep during that one. Then I got the first part of it and then must have drifted off to sleep during that one.
Yeah. So, you know, what I got out of this one, he said that there are many followers of Christ, and some of the greatest followers of Christ that he's seen are not even members of the church, but that there are things that they can add to what they have. If they seek out and they join the church. And so he gave two characteristics, and again, he broke away from the traditional three pattern, two characteristics of followers of Christ. And the first one is that you love people, so that you exhibit love. And the second one is that you make and keep covenants. And, you know, the greatest example of the first one of love was the atonement. And so he talked about that for a bit. And then the second one with covenants, he talked about God making a covenant before the foundation of the earth, and how taking the sacrament and doing temple work were all examples of covenants, and how that part of keeping covenants and making covenants was what non-Mormons could add to all of the good that they already do as Christians. That's what they could.
Except I would say almost to the detriment of his message.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of these things, it's like, okay, covenants, all right, these magic things, what's different between what other people do outside than inside? I mean, yes, as a you know, someone with a Mormon background, I know the answer. I mean,
right.
It's that typical Sunday school answer. But to somebody who's outside the church, they'd say, well, excuse me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I understand. But, I mean, to me, the analogy I made is that he kind of stood out like a sore thumb from the other speakers to me. And kind of his ecumenical attitude towards other Christians, but he still had to be part of the hand. If that makes any, I mean, that's how I felt about it. Like he didn't have the cultural Utah speak. He didn't seem to have the cultural Utah Mormon type attitudes about things. But of course, he still had to take a literal interpretation of the mythology, that there were these covenants that were made before the foundation of the world, and that those are renewed through the sacrament, similar to what L. Town Perry had talked about being the central purpose of our worship on Sunday, that that's a literal thing that you actually do, and that's what Mormonism has to offer that others in the Christian world doesn't have, which would justify his own conversion. I don't know if he's a convert or if his family's a convert or you know, what it would be. But I mean, I can understand where he would be coming from, that that would be an important part of his message. But I thought the way that he focused on loving people, and especially that that love was putting your own, like that you suffer for people, and that Christ's atonement of, you know, suffering for people was the ultimate show of love. I found that touching and inspiring more than anything else that I heard, except maybe Irings at the end. I liked that. But
well, his example about when you were talking about, you know, suffering showing love, and he was giving some examples of that, and he brought up Brother Jimmy Oliveira from Ecuador, who received his mission call. And as he and his family was very, sounded like, you know, really hurting, destitute, and realized as he left, going on his mission, he could, quote, lose his family, I believe, and that he walked out the door with a broken heart. And later on during his mission, his mom asked him to stay away longer because they were receiving so many blessings.
Right, yeah.
And you know what? That was the only time I noticed the audience, like something very audible going on in the audience. And I rewound several times or went back a couple of times to try to figure out what it was that the audience was doing.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't supposed to be funny, I don't think. And I didn't hear laughter. Did they realize that it was really kind of weird? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think that was the laughter of connection. That like, oh, yes, of course. They're laughing because
darn.
It's true, right? All right, so how about Kent F. Richards? Who wants to give us a summary there?
I will. One of the things that I noticed about Elder Richard was it was basically the analog of spiritual pain to physical pain and what pain can help us, kind of what it can help teach us in our lives. I mean, he made a lot of analogies about how pain is means you're healing, pain is good for you and stuff like that, and that spiritual pain can overcome. The thing that kind of turned me off at the end was I'm really sensitive to near-death experiences and angels, only because they're crap. And
hey!
And so when he goes in there as a physician and he's talking about this, you know, wonderful little girl who was, you know, near dying, pulling out all this stuff, I'm just sitting there going, okay, I call foul. I know that he's trying to make this wonderful point, but I'm sorry, I'm calling foul on this message. But the overall message, I think, was rather poignant, especially in these kind of trying times with the economic recession and the earthquake.
Well, does anyone on the panel not think that angels and near-death experiences are crap?
Man, I don't know.
Does anybody not think that they're crap?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that they're crap.
Okay, good. So stick it to Nathan. What are you going to let? You're going to let him call that crap?
We could go on and on and on about this topic.
But, I know.
We're going to exceed our time limit if we do so.
Isn't that a shame? These arbitrary time restrictions that we have here.
Well, I'd say, hey, that's great. Show me. If I'm trying to remember the name of the Dutch realist painter who said, when asked why he never painted angels, he said, well, show me an angel and I'll paint one. Yeah, that's what it reminds me whenever I hear stories of angelic beings and such. But anyway.
Yeah, it's just that when I hear things like that, there's so many people who put value and belief into it to you know, and looking at the way that Richards, I had a similar reaction, Nathan, to be honest. When I was listening to what he had to say, I was kind of going, okay, I'm kind of with him with this talk. And he kind of lost me at that point. And I went, oh, yeah. But it's kind of more that cynical part where I want the connection when somebody's in an ICU and they're having this powerful moment with somebody who's close to them that's going to be passing. if it were me, and I think back to like my grandmother, I want that connection to be between me and her, and not kind of filtered through the spirits and these angels and other things. But that's just me, and I you know, have to kind of step back and recognize, okay, there's other people who still have that belief in those other things, and not kind of belittle them for that. Right?
But you understand that wanting to believe in those things doesn't make those things true. That,
sure.
They don't magically exist because I really, really want those spirits
right.
to be around me.
But
it's a
Dutch painter.
Nice,
but a Dutch painter not being able to paint them because he hasn't seen them doesn't make them not true either.
Well, that's true. You can't prove a negative.
Yeah.
However, the burden of evidence is on the person.
Right,
the claim.
But it's just about a respectful dialogue is what I'm talking about, and so.
Well, yeah. for the venue, I would expect. I mean, yeah, it's LDS conference. That's exactly what you get.
Yeah.
However, I took umbrage at it.
Okay.
If you want to get more into it, we can schedule time another time.
We should. Fun stuff. Okay, Quentin L. Cook.
Obligatory women are great talk.
Okay, wait a minute. Okay, yes, the obligatory women are great, but we're not really going to give them any power talk. Come on.
Yes. Yeah. But our LDS women are incredible.
Well, what was
they are.
What was the book that he quoted?
American Grace.
Was that where LDS women are overwhelmingly satisfied with their role?
I don't know if it actually said. I didn't read it, so I don't know if it actually said they're satisfied with their roles. But what it said was they're. What was making the rounds on blogs and being discussed is that Mormon women were the ones who were most opposed to being ordained, basically. They had answered the question. Mormon men were actually more in favor of seeing women ordained than Mormon women.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the only group for which that was true. So I don't know if that was what he was talking about. But, one of the authors of American Grace is LDS. I'm not entirely surprised that it was brought up and quoted.
Mm.
But I did notice a very succinct dichotomy between Mormon women versus non-Mormon women, which is kind of the point. But one of the things that kind of bugged me was that it was like he was projecting all of this materialism onto the non-Mormon women for their life choices, but saying, oh, Mormon women, if they have to do the same life choices, it's because they had the prayerful, you know, they had to. They thought about this. And I'm thinking that's kind of disingenuous for both sides of this debate here. I mean,
yeah, and he made that appeal to the pioneer. What was her name? Elizabeth Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And you know, I mean, I don't. Had any of you heard of her or her story before?
No.
I hadn't, but it just made me think of the different people that you study in church history and the times where they say, oh, church history doesn't matter. Don't look at church historical things. You know, think about now. But, you know, there are certain things that when it does support the message, yeah, we'll turn and we'll
Definitely.
Talk about Elizabeth Jackson. But it just made me wonder, did she ever waver? Were there other women in similar situations who didn't respond the same way that she did? You know, would it really even matter if there were in a conference talk like that to bring those examples up? You know, is that something worth exploring to a Quentin L. Cook or not? Or is it, we're just going to take that one example and go with it? And, you know, but anyway, I mean, those are the kinds of things that I would be interested in finding more information on.
He kept talking about women, how they have Mormon women have a unique and essential role, he said.
Mm-hmm.
But he never actually listed anything that was unique to women or that was essentially done by women other than, you know, having children. You know, he talked about how they were able to activate priesthood holders and get priesthood holders going on missions and going to the temple. But men can do that too. And it's something that I've asked on blogs and in different conversations with people like, oh, it's about separate gender roles. Women have their own role. Men have priesthood. It's like, well, what's the role of women? And I never get anything that's actually unique to women other than have babies. And a lot of people have gotten mad at me for pointing that out, but it's really the truth. There isn't a unique and essential role for women in Mormonism that has to be done by women. And talks like this are kind of frustrating because he just takes the stuff that isn't unique and essential to women and talks about what they do and then calls it unique and essential when it's not. And I realize that I'm one of those people who's not really going to be happy until, you know, I actually start to see change. So almost any talk about women is going to disgruntle me until then. But I just feel like talks like this, you know, it offers so much high praise to women without actually trying to address any of the problems. You know, it tries to pretend that everything is rosy and glorious when it's not. And that troubles me a lot.
Do you see it done better other places, Bridget?
Oh, definitely. I mean, other churches certainly struggle with treating women well. That's not an issue, but other places are making progress. I think I've mentioned to you guys before that I attend a church that ordains women. My pastor's a woman. Our board of elders is, I think we've got 7 elders and 4 or 5 of them are women. So yeah, other people are doing better. My pastor can perform baptism. She can serve communion. Women can do everything in my church.
So that would make it more unique to be able to perform those ordinances.
I don't really believe in separate roles. I think that you should be able to do whatever you are able to do. So I don't think that giving women unique roles is really the solution, because you would have to take away stuff from men and say, like, okay, men aren't going to do this anymore because men are already doing everything. So, or they're able to do everything. I don't really think that separate roles is the answer. I think that letting people do what they're gifted and talented for is the answer. And if women are good at holding the priesthood and being bishops or whatever.
Amen, Bridget. And I agree even on the other side, because there's a lot of people, myself included, who have talents in areas that have been traditionally defined as being women's roles, like cooking and homemaking and music and things like that. And it's to the point where it's like, come on. But yeah, exactly.
Right, for both men and women. And I realize that men get that a little bit too when they're good at things that are traditionally feminine and people try to push them into the masculine provider stuff. But yeah, for both sexes, I think it's just better for people to do what they're good at.
All right. Well, yeah, take that, Quentin L. Cook. Oh, go ahead.
This talk will be referenced for years to come, and we have to mention it because of the story of this purse. The purse that's found at the end of a steak dance, and there's no identifying marks on the outside of it, and so they proceed to dig through it, and they find out all of these things that make the signs of a wonderful young woman until they finally get to it. This story that'll be in young women's talks for year. What's in your wallet, and what's in your purse, and what do you carry with you that identifies yourself as a faithful member of the church? This will be all over the place. Next week, you will hear about this in 3/4 of the talks.
Yeah.
Yes, and her actual individual identity was the very least important and, you know, the very final thing to come out of that purse.
Yeah.
After about halfway through that, I just said, okay, this can't be a real purse. Who's keeping recipes for angel food cake or whatever cake it was in the purse? But, yeah, it's...
Well, see, I noticed it was church things that were most important, the church stuff, and then good hygiene. So, anyway.
All right. Okay. All right. Final speaker was Henry B. Eyring. Okay.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add something good, because since we really railed on him, I figured there was one thing I really, really liked about his talk, which was he mentioned 2 things that... I'm not sure if it was people in general, or speaking directly to women, maybe you guys can correct me, but he said, 1, no woman should ever apologize or think that her role is less significant. And then 2, that we should be careful not to be judgmental if women work outside of the home, because we don't know the individual circumstances. So I think the 2 was probably the best thing out of this whole talk, and I really hope that people take it to heart not to be judgmental for women that work outside of the home.
All right. Hear, hear. Good. Okay, and our final speaker was Henry B. Eyring. And to me... This kind of bookended what started with President Uchtdorf mentioning the 75th anniversary of the welfare program and President Monson mentioning the relief efforts in Japan with the recent earthquake. And it just seemed like the first presidency had kind of gotten together and said, okay, here's the message that we want to set forward in this conference. And I thought that Henry B. Eyring did a great job with it. I thought it was a good message. I've already mentioned I might be taking a little bit more cynical interpretation of this than it deserves. But, you know, the first thing that jumped out at me was that throughout the history of the church, this has been called different things: consecration, the United Order, and now the welfare program. But it's all the same thing. And I think Sidney Rigdon somewhere rolled over in his grave. So what'd you guys think about that? Is this the same thing as the United Order?
No, absolutely not. Anybody who's read in more than one sentence of D. Michael Quinn's books on the origin of power and the Great Basin Kingdom would tell you that it or not. I'm actually kind of surprised that how little they downplayed a lot of the help. I mean, they have a history of all of this humanitarian aid, and the most recent example, of course, being the earthquake in Japan. But I'm actually surprised how little they actually downplayed their involvement in these humanitarian projects. I mean, they could have definitely gone much further in their descriptions of what the church has done in the last 50 years or even the last 10 years.
Well, the amazing thing with that as well is with as many things has been done over the last many years, how many times the old Teton Dam story keeps getting trotted out and being used. Now, to his credit, I understand why he would bring it up. He had personal interaction with that happened in 76, but that's been 35 years. You'd think there would be more recent examples that we could use about, you know, people's homes floating away and stuff like that. I'm so tired of that damn story that
yes.
I thought it was interesting that he was really touting service. He had more call for contributions. They announced that with this 75th anniversary, there's going to be a day of service done again this year. I think it's been a few years since that was done. So, you know, there'll be a lot of effort coming out this year. Every one of us will probably be given 3 or 4 helping hands, yellow T-shirts to wear. So I think that's kind of a portent for what's going to be going on. And then in October, there'll be a lot of fanfare about various examples of what was done this year for service opportunities.
I still don't think it's an accident that's happening right before Romney and Huntsman are getting ready to run for the presidency. It can't be an accident.
Well, you could find
relationships no matter what. If we didn't do anything, there could be parallels that could be placed because something else. I don't know if they're thinking, gee, this would be a great year for year of service, and it aligns with Huntsman and Romney. I don't.
It's not a bad thing. I mean, I thought it was great that the first presidency is giving out assignments in General Conference. If you've got the forum and you've got the attention of everybody, use it. That's great. Go out, get in your communities, do service. Fantastic. I like it. But I still think there's something more to it.
Could be.
Well, one way to test your hypothesis is to see what the theme of the October conference would be.
Yeah.
See if we get more of this push for that to be a very telling thing.
Yeah. And it just seemed like even in his message, there was a lot of kind of subtle political, you know, the people who help themselves first, or the families help themselves, or what dignity people have when they themselves are involved in things. It just seemed like there was a lot of that kind of, I don't know, maybe they're timing it with the release of Atlas Shrugged as well. I don't know.
And also, if it was going to have a direct impact on that, wouldn't it have been better to wait until 2012 and launch this in April of 2012 if you're really going to have try and make an impact on a presidential election run?
Well, except for that by the time that the 2012s rolled around, the primaries are done by April. So really, it would make more sense to get a push in October. I mean,
in October,
are,
yeah. To, yeah, to make it through the primaries, and then if your guy makes it, then the big push would be in April of next year.
So you're mobilizing the base right now, so you can actually get some substance behind the claims that you're going to make. Look at what the church has been doing. You know, this is the kind of organization that we are.
However, I think
it's a good thing anyway.
I could talk for hours on that. Let's not.
All right. Any final words then?
One last.
Yeah.
One last mention about the music. I thought the Mormon Tabernacle Choir was quite nice, but it seemed like they were kind of holding back. I mean, it was mostly hymns or an arrangement of hymns. And I know that in the past they've done some just amazing musical work, and I thought this one was a little solid, but...
Okay. I thought there was definitely a focus on the Savior, but both in the choices of the hymns and the messages. You know, a lot of times there's criticism that the church doesn't focus on Jesus, they don't focus on the atonement, and I thought that every single one of these messages mentioned Jesus prominently, and I thought that was at least a feather in their cap, something worth mentioning. So.
Yes.
Watching the Twitter feeds, there was a lot of mentions of the guy who was leading the music.
Yeah.
And his facial expressions, and a lot of kids, I guess, were getting a kick out of watching his eyebrows bounce all over the place.
Nice. All right. Okay, anything else?
Well, to hit on the closing prayer, I did notice a phrase that I really liked. It was mentioned turning sympathy, having our sympathy turn to action.
Yeah.
Because I often get tired of prayers where you pray for all these things to happen, but then, you know, people don't do anything. So the idea of our sympathy turning to action.
Good point. Amen on that. All right, guys. Well, thanks for taking time out on your Sunday afternoon.
Sunday?
Saturday. All right, guys.
Saturday. It feels like Sunday since we're watching conference.
Thanks for taking time out on your Saturday afternoon. How about we do that?
Well, thanks for letting me participate.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome to the Saturday PM session, Mormon Expression. I'm your host, Tom, and I brought on a pretty awesome panel tonight, today, this morning. Did I just say tonight, this morning? I want to start off by introducing him. Let's start off with the always controversial but loved Mike T. What's up, Mike? Thanks for joining us, man.
Oh, it's good to be off probation.
And then our church statistician, the guy that's a lot smarter than most of us, Alf Omega. What's up, Alf?
Howdy.
And then we've got Tierza from Mormon Expression Blogs, who's been on Mormon Expression before. What's up, Tierza?
Not much.
All right. Well, thanks you guys for joining us. We're going to be talking about the Saturday afternoon session. President Uchtdorf, the always charismatic. You can always hear kind of the girls go, whoa, when he gets up there and he starts to preside.
Not just the girls.
Not just the... Yeah, it's true. I did kind of get my breath taken away when he got up, so... they did the calling and sustaining of the leaders, and then they ran down the church statistical report. Why don't you lead us off with that, Alf? I noticed that the church numbers were at, what, 14,000,001? Is that about right?
Yeah, 14,131,467. We probably shouldn't assume that people have been following my projections about those, but I predicted that let me back up a second. Every year I do a set of predictions where I take the last 5 years of all the various categories in the statistical report. Then I project them linearly, just fit a straight line curve to, if that's not a self-contradiction, a straight line to the last 5 years of data, see where it projects the next year will be. And then I predict whether that projection is high or low. And I predicted that the straight line for the total membership would be high. No, actually, I didn't. I predicted that the straight line would be low. And I also ran an exponential projection and predicted that would be high. Well, it turned out that the actual number was below both of those projections, which was a little surprising. I've observed, and it's not too hard to figure out that the total membership figure has been increasing, but slowing down its growth rate for a number of years, and it just slowed down a little faster than I would have expected this time around.
This year it looked like we had 4 baptisms per missionary. Is that average, or what is your statistics?
I actually count 5.22 per missionary.
Okay, so,
is my math, but that itself is about average for recent missionary effort. What is a little different is that if you take the converts per 1,000 members, which is another number I've been tracking, this is the lowest ever. That I have numbers back to the early 70s, just the ones that are publicly available on LDS.org. I could probably go back to earlier conference reports and project it farther back. But in the modern, Ensign era of conference statistical reports, 19.31 converts per 1,000 members is lower than any previous year. Some other things that are a little that show, the kind of where things have slowed down quite a bit. Missionaries per stake is just over 18, which it was last year, but it's just even slightly smaller this year. That's a fairly low number. I mean, it's an all-time low since the 70s. And then members per missionary, that is, there's 271 members of the church for every missionary out in the field. And I'm not counting the service missionaries. That was a newly reported category this year. So just if you take the full-time proselytizing missionaries, which is what I believe the 52,225 missionaries figure represents, there's about 271 members per missionary, and that's, again, an all-time high. So we're not producing missionaries out of the total membership quite as efficiently as we have before.
I was just going to say, the baseline of the membership numbers that you say seem to be slowing down or stagnating a little bit, and you said that was surprising?
A little bit. I mean, we've known it's been slowing down. I guess the rate this year surprised me a little bit, that it was the all-time low, except for there was one year back in the early 70s when the total membership increase was under 2%. Every year since then has been higher than that. Like in the late 70s, it got as high as 6%, and then throughout the 80s, it was mostly 4%. There was one year in the late 90s or late 80s that was 8%, but I think that was mainly due to a change in the way they count the growth. But this year, 2.22% growth, which is lower than all but those that early year in the 70s. The other thing that grows out of that is that if you count the members per ward or branch, that's 493. That's an all-time high. And members per stake or district is 4,026. And that's an all-time high. So they continue to grow, but it appears to be slowing down somewhat. I don't think it's going to stop growing anytime soon. But it's, the years of increasing growth, I think, are behind the church, and it's now decreasing growth, and it's a different kind of curve for them to get used to.
Yeah, I remember when we did the podcast with you about the church statistic numbers, you had predicted that it'd crest 14 million, and that was maybe a year ago when we talked about that?
I think we talked after the last annual conference, and yeah, I predicted that the next year would see us pass 14 million, which we did, and that's not surprising.
Yeah. But I was actually expecting a 14.2 or 3, maybe a 5. That I didn't expect a 14.1. I think you're right. I think it's slowing down a little bit. Okay, let's see. And the choir was the Ricks College Choir. I mean, BYU, Idaho. And then...
I'm a descendant of Thomas Ricks, and so...
Are you really?
Yes, having Brigham Young take that one over too just seems like typical Brigham Young.
Stealing away your family name. What a ripoff.
That's right.
All right. And the first speaker, who I was pretty excited to see, was President Boyd K. Packer. So, Mike, he didn't come out with any homophobic rhetoric. That was good. There was a hint,
but he covered the history of the church from the apostasy to today. He stated, this is something I caught, it is the Church of Christ, do not call yourselves Mormons.
Yeah, that was a little surprising. Why did he say that? Why is he like, he makes the clear distinction. He's like, it's okay if other people refer to us as the Mormon Church, but not us. We can't refer to ourselves as the Mormon Church.
I just think he wants us to remember who we are and that we're Christians. We're baptized in Christ's name and don't use our nickname.
Hmm.
Well, I think it's interesting because
give yourself more dignity than a nickname, I think.
Yeah. In the past, you know, they've tried to tell other people not to call us the Mormon Church, but obviously that hasn't worked.
I'm wondering if the Mormon Tabernacle Choir is due for a rename.
Yeah. I just don't understand the reason why I guess being called calling ourselves the Mormon Church is so offensive. I don't know. Yeah, he reemphasized that we call ourselves Latter-day Saints if you need to use the short term. And then he talked about, we are Christians. The one thing that I notice is he says that the wife sustains her husband. That was nice to hear reiterated.
Husband is the head of the home. The wife is the heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not sure what the anatomical distinction there is. But I did like that he said equal partnership. Hopefully that's the message that came through.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. And one of the key things that he mentioned that I took notice of is where he says, we have members being offended. Some can't leave it alone. A Latter-day Saint is an ordinary individual. Why can't they just let it alone?
Well, I got that he wants us to leave the historical controversies alone and focus on the blessings that are available to us in the here and now. And as far as prophets making mistakes, is all of us are prophets, and all of us make mistakes, and all of us are capable of greatness.
I don't remember him necessarily talking about any historical controversies. I just thought he was referring to members in general being offended. I don't know. Did he mention something about historical controversies?
I got the feeling that he was talking about historical stuff, too.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't very explicit, but I got that feeling.
I mean, the one explicit example he shared was a man being embittered by his wife dying at the hands of a small-town doctor who gave her the infection he'd been working on just previous. It took him many years to realize that that guy was doing just the best he could, and there's really no good reason to blame him for his wife dying. And that sort of example, that's the kind of thing that if he was talking about historical controversies, it's a nice bit of sleight of hand to go from a personal affront to being offended by historical facts.
Right. I'm just tired. I'm honestly tired of hearing about how members get offended and that's the problem and blah, blah, blah. I mean, I don't know too many people that left the church because they're offended. I know it does happen, Mike. Relax. I know it happens. I'm just thinking that there's quite a few people that's not really an issue of being offended.
I don't think his talk has to be read as referring to historical controversy, but if it is, you know, it's if you choose to take that reading of it, then this is a disjunction. This personal affront versus historical fact.
Right.
Well, I think he talked. I kind of got the feeling that he talked around a lot of things, like when he was talking about the misuse of procreative power. He didn't talk about homosexuality per se, but he talked about people feeling like it's unfair that they're tempted or, you know, I mean, he kind of was talking about homosexuality,
right?
But he didn't come out and say that this time.
Yeah, he said the law of chastity, as one of the key Mormon doctrines says, is for men and women only to... I guess marry, and adultery is comparable to murder. And like you said, all of us are tested and tempted, but we all have real things to overcome.
Yeah, I was sitting there with my pen on my paper thinking, okay, go ahead, President Packer, say it. But yeah, he never really didn't say it this time around.
That's still fairly high stakes when you talk about sexual sin being next to murder. I think the church is going to continue to have a lot of difficulty with the society at large, which it probably doesn't mind, as long as it keeps these stakes about sexual sin that high. Not just society, though. I mean, if when you have regular, ordinary people, just like Mormons, who are trying to deal with the strength of sexual urges, you know, that's you pile that on a young Aaronic priesthood holder who considers he's doing something that's pretty close to murder when he does acts perfectly naturally. That's a real powder keg, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not a new powder keg. Nothing new there.
The doctrine behind it is that there's an old Jewish custom that if you kill someone, you're killing not just them, but all their posterity. And when you put that in reverse, if you have a child out of wedlock and you're cutting off his roots, then you're stealing from him all his forebears. So it's the opposite of murder in that you're cutting a person off from all the things that make them who they could be.
Well, that doesn't really apply to non-procreative sexual sin, though, does it?
Yeah. Let's go ahead and move on. Let's poor Mike.
Oh, one thing I wanted to mention. He ended by saying, do a lot of forgiving and a little repenting.
He did. And the other one that I smiled is when he says, it's not easy being a Latter-day Saint. If someone's looking for a church that requires very little, this is not the one. All right.
There was a fairly big pause at the end of his talk. I got the impression he was actually sitting in a chair or something, some kind of a stool up at the pulpit. The camera work pretty made it difficult to tell what exactly was going on there.
Yeah, they scan back, so it's like, okay, there's everybody. Nobody knows what's really holding up things. Yeah, that was kind of interesting. The second speaker was the Apostle Russell M. Nelson. I thought it was interesting when he talks about there was an 18-month-old son or kid that recognized his voice, and then he later says, oh yeah, that was my grandson. It's okay.
Did you see that one coming?
Well, I was kind of thinking he was going to play up the celebrityness of the apostles, you know, but he's like, nah, it's my grandson. It's okay. That was kind of funny.
And the focus on his talk was to prepare to meet God as a family. And the highlight of it, I thought, for those listening to this show, is that the cafeteria approach to Mormonism does not work.
Yeah. We were going to get there,
There's
Mike.
No other approach to Mormonism.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, and he actually brought it up. He actually brought up that term cafeteria, right? Where he says the cafeteria style of picking and choosing which commandments to obey will not work.
That was great.
You liberal mamby-pamby Mormons, knock it off.
It's not only that it won't work, but didn't he say that it would lead to misery?
Yep. Yeah.
Like,
go ahead.
The overall approach he went for, I'm sorry. The overall approach he went for was that when you grow up in the church as a family instead of an individual, you're creating a culture. And if you're going to try and pick and choose, it's like trying to pick and choose what part of your culture you're going to be a part of.
You know, this gets so sticky, though, Mike. Everybody picks and chooses. Like Alpha was just saying a minute ago, everybody is a cafeteria Mormon to some degree. Where exactly do you draw the line? That just drives me crazy that he's just going to go ahead and throw that down. Cafeteria style picking and choosing is not acceptable and it won't work. Come on.
I think what's better, a better way to look at it is everybody has their individual strengths in the church. And, you know, in a family situation, maybe your brother's stronger at some part of the gospel than you are. That doesn't mean you abandon the parts you're weak at. It means you cling to your friends and family that are strong in areas you're not and grow together.
You can still make a complete meal at a cafeteria.
You share off each other's plates.
One thing I want to call him out on, he referred to divorce rates rising. They're actually not. They've been falling, at least in the United States, they've been falling since the early 90s.
Yeah, he did mention that, huh, didn't he? Yeah, he said the divorce rates. Yeah.
I think that's just one of those things that people throw out as, you know, these days are never as good as the good old days and things are bad now in the way they weren't before. Well, they're better now in ways that they haven't been.
Well, he focused a lot on how we need to be or how the world is frightening right now. I mean, he focused on fear was a big
yeah,
jumping off point for him.
Yeah, he brought up the earthquakes. Yeah, he brought up the earthquakes and tsunamis and the government collapsing and all that stuff.
And he said that we'd be that the church members would be persecuted, that there'd be a lot of persecution coming up.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting when he says that paying tithing eventually becomes a privilege. And then he mentioned that it will protect you in the day of burning. That was an old school reference. Hey,
yeah,
fire tithing is fire insurance. Yeah.
Still there. the other a part I like, too, is that he testified that angels are real and recognize that they're about you and trying to help you.
Yeah, that they were on call. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you could call them up or, you know, they've got their pager set or whatever. Okay, the third speaker was Richard Maines.
Maines.
Of the 70. There wasn't too much that I put in my notes about this guy. Family.
Came out in favor of the family.
Yeah. I did mark this down where he said the Satan's three-prong attack, selfishness, greed, and porn. I thought that was interesting. Those three things are the really bad things that Satan uses.
He did call out that the sins of the children will be on the parents if the parents haven't taught them the gospel.
Yeah, that was that. Yeah.
I could just hear my mother listening to that and coming back to me on that one in a few days here.
Yeah, like parents need any more guilt with their kids. I mean, I don't know.
Well, part of the judgment is that your kids are going to testify about you on Judgment Day as to what you taught them and how they acted as to what you taught them. So he's being right. He's being correct.
Yeah, but does a parent really need to hear about if their kid makes some bad decisions that those bad decisions are going to fall on their head?
That's not what it is. It's did you teach them?
That's
not
what it sounds like.
Did you take the culture of the celestial kingdom, bring it into your home, and apply that to your kids? What they do with that knowledge is something different. But
it sounds like Mike that what he was saying is that whatever mistakes your kids make, that's going to fall on you if you didn't, because they wouldn't have made those decisions if they were taught right.
Well, part of his talk was what scriptures and prayers say won't be remembered, but the habits you developed in those children will be remembered. And if you need to establish a culture that brings about the Holy Ghost to your kids. And that's what his emphasis was. Teach them good habits and bring that culture into their lives.
I don't think parents need too much prompting to feel bad about their children's choices.
Yeah, I think they do enough of that on their own. All right, let's move on. Fourth speaker, Cecil O. Samuelson, Jr. of the 70.
Now he's the president of BYU, right?
Is he?
Yeah, I believe
so. You're right, yeah.
All right, well,
when he was talking about working with young people. So he was talking about all the young people of the church and how encouraged he was. I think that's what he's talking about is his interactions with BYU students.
Right at the beginning, he says, the youth of the church are dealing with a lot of questions and doubts. Most come from honest inquiry. That was surprising. I thought he was going to elaborate on that, but he didn't really.
Yeah, I was really sad about that, actually. Well, yeah. Not sad. I wasn't surprised at all. But I just thought, you know, he raised that issue that young people have questions and doubts and concerns about the church. But then that will never, ever, ever be addressed in conference. I mean, he went on to address some sort of namby-pamby stuff about testimony that no real – I mean, you know, like that's not the real issue at all.
Yeah, this whole talk was about testimonies. And it towards the end, he says, if you're struggling, then listen to the testimonies that are shared in this conference. Well, that's it?
Okay. You can trust them.
Yeah. Any thoughts from you, Mike?
I just got excited at the start, like you said. I thought it was going to be another Seven Deadly Heresies type talk, and then he went into testimony. But it was a good thing on testimony. I like what he had to say about testimonies. Like, at the start, you're going, yeah, another Seven Deadly Heresies, and then he drops the ball.
He talked about questions that people have based on honest inquiry, and then went on to answer the sort of questions that are not usually asked by honest inquirers.
Yes, exactly.
Who's entitled to have a testimony? How do you obtain the necessary revelation, and what are the steps? And is obtaining a testimony an event or an ongoing process? He answered the questions that they should have been asking, not the questions they were actually asking.
Right. No, he asked the questions that they ask you in Sunday school.
Exactly. And he says people do good in important things because they have testimonies. the second part he says, but we also gain testimonies by doing good. People do good because they have testimonies? I don't, all right. That's my last
one. This is going to be a good talk to review when you're doing a priesthood lesson later this year, because it has all these bullet points, and you can go 1 through 10 and discuss each one in a class later this year.
I don't know. Just testimony, testimony, testimony.
Teachers do like their bullet points.
Yeah. They do. All right. Fifth speaker, Dallin H. Oaks. And he just went ahead and said what his topic was about is like desire.
And it was laid out like a legal brief, like all his talks are.
Exactly. And he talks about our physical desires. He talked about food, shelter, sleep, staying away from our desire from worldly possessions. And then he also brought up the Aaron Ralston story about cutting off his own arm with a Swiss Army knife. That was pretty But he brought up one thing that I wasn't, because I haven't read Aaron Ralston's story or watched the movie. He said that Aaron Ralston had a vision of seeing his 3-year-old future son. That was surprising. I didn't know that. Do you guys know that?
I don't remember hearing that, but it sounds I've heard Aaron Ralston interviewed, and it sounds like he considered the whole experience just a turning point in his life for the better.
As a spiritual or visionary thingy?
I'm not sure how much visionary particularly, but it wouldn't surprise me. It sounded consistent with his evaluation of the experience.
Huh.
And I was kind of moved by that. I like, you know, I'm fond of 3-year-old kids. I've had several of them myself. And I can imagine having, you know, reaching the extremity where I needed to cut off my arm to be able to cradle a 3-year-old boy. That's something I would admire in another person. I think I'd see in myself.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's interesting that you go 5 days without food or necessarily water. You might actually have a vision at that point that's not really a spiritual.
And if it gives you the strength to do something that will save your life, you know, all the better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think his story is pretty cool. But one of the things that I heard him say is he says, all should try to marry. Marriage and having children should be a priority. Then he went on to share the story about this young woman, or this single young woman, said that there's a lot of young righteous men that don't have any desire to marry, and they're not marrying us. What's the problem? That was pretty funny.
Well, you know, one thing you can look at this
rebuttal.
Yeah.
One way to look at this is we're all born with physical desires, and we can change our inherent physical desires by properly developing the good ones that we need in our lives. So if you're looking for another thing against the homosexual issue, this talk is focused on that.
All right, just put away the homosexual thing for a second. What's wrong with somebody that just decides they want to be single, Mike? Why is that so bad?
Because it's against the plan of happiness. They focused a number of times on this, that the family is the central thing.
But aren't single people? I mean, because this all this really made me feel like is the older single people, members of the church, who are like, oh yeah, I know, I want to get married too, but they can't, or they don't have the opportunity. Do they really need to deal with that additional guilt? Because the church leaders tell them, you know, if you don't get married in this life, you'll get an opportunity to choose a spouse in the next life. So what's the problem?
Well, they did focus on the fact that angels are real, so you have that goal if you don't want to get married.
Oh, jeez.
The family is the central core of the gospel. Everything, we have a father in heaven, Christ is our brother, we have a mother in heaven. I mean, that's the whole plan, is this culture of family where we support one another and draw on one another's strengths and encourage one another. And
it's true, you know, the church is ideally set up for functioning nuclear families, and it's not a good fit for people who are persistently single. And I married in my early 30s, so I was able to see from the inside the functioning of the church as it pertains to singles, and there are a lot of compromises. There are a lot of not ideal arrangements when you are dealing with singles in the church. It just doesn't fit very well. I think this thing about desire, well, first of all, I should say that me being single was kind of a mutual agreement between me and the rest of the women in the church. Till finally I found somebody who was smart enough to be interesting, but dumb enough to be interested. So it's a difficult balance for a lot of singles. I didn't get a lot of flack because it was pretty clear that I was looking pretty hard. But be that as it may, it was a talk about desire, and I think the connection with Alma and his faith discourse was pretty obvious, and he mentioned that early on, that faith begins with desire, and I think that's the way the church. That's the thing the church relies upon for convincing people of things that they can't see. The fact is, if you can't see God or any evidence of things that the church is claiming, the desire for those things to be true is the basis for people's conviction that it's true. So on that, Elder Oaks and I agree. Whether that's the way knowledge should be constructed, I think we disagree there.
Just in my ward, as far as going back to the single people, I mean, there's a older single woman in my ward who's never married, and she's probably in her late 50s now. And this is all she talks about. Yeah, I want to marry. I want to marry. I want to marry, because she feels like that's her single one thing that's holding her back from being righteous or getting blessings or being recognized by Heavenly Father or whatever. And it's terrible to see her so depressed all the time. I just wish that maybe they'd say, you know what, it's all right being single. It's okay. You know, just find other ways to be happy.
Maybe they should say it's all right to practice polygamy again, and then we can take care of those people.
Oh, Mike.
You first, Mike. It is heartbreaking. I know older single women as well, and even without – Elder Oaks made it pretty much his emphasis that the difficulty is with the males, primarily. And that came up, I think, in a priesthood talk too, didn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
But that it is, this is the plight of singles is largely a plight of single women. They're the ones who are differentially stay faithful longer than men. And so there's this growing disparity between available single men and available single women. And it's heartbreaking. There's just there's no good solution to it.
No, and I don't think the issue is just people selfishly not wanting to get married, which sort of seems to be the message, I guess.
Yeah, that's what he's pointing at. I don't think that's the majority.
I don't think that's the issue.
Well, when you take a population of people who are not married, as the average age increases, the people who are more marriageable drop out of that population, leaving the less marriageable. It is increasingly an equation that can't be solved.
Right.
I mean, but what if somebody doesn't want – I mean, like, what about the gay members of the church? I mean, what if they choose not to marry, you know, bam. What's wrong with being single? That's all I'm saying. I've got single friends. What's freaking wrong with being single? And no, Mike, polygamy's not the answer. All right. We'll move on.
Why shoot for the top of the trees when you can shoot for the stars?
The last speaker, Russell M. Ballard, and this was actually my favorite talk of this session. I didn't necessarily disagree or have any issues with any of it. He talked about the golden rule. He talked about serving others, small and precious things. He even talked about spring bringing flowers. I thought it was nice.
It was a great talk. I like the nuggets, the flex and the nuggets allegory.
Yeah.
I only had one little tiny problem with it, and this is just a me thing, but he did say that it's only the love of the Savior that enables us to love others. And since I'm still struggling with where I've come down on my faith in Jesus, you know, I don't think that it's only the Savior that enables us to love others. But you know, that's something that nobody in the church would argue with.
Right. Alf, no statistics in this talk.
The charity rate seems to be holding steady, so I think we're good there.
All right. Said the gospel simple, don't make it complicated.
I like all what, in all. Go ahead.
I was just going to say all these talks seem to be pretty, you know, non-controversial, mellow.
Yeah, a lot of him-ha, like, yeah, it's more of the same. Yeah, I mean, there wasn't any, Boyd K. Packer let us down. He didn't bring up anything that was crazy.
Besides, that's all he could do to get to the pulpit, to give the guy a break.
Yeah, that's true. All right, so Mike, was the Saturday afternoon session better than the Saturday a.m. session?
I've enjoyed all of them. I really enjoyed priesthood session last night. There was a lot of great talks in that.
Any controversy there? Did they say that polygamy's coming back or that...
Unfortunately, no.
Masturbation's okay.
Sorry, Tom. You're not allowed to yet.
Okay, good. Good. All right. Well, Mike, Alf, Tierza, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having us.
And I guess I'll turn the rest of the time back over to John. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Okay.